Hi, Ross.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
I'm good.
I'm also good. It's nice to be here for a special Hanukkah and Advent edition of Blogging Heads.
Yes. I should have brought candles, I guess.
Well, I'm wearing a slightly holiday-ish sweater. It's got some red on it.
So that's good.
Yeah. So should we start out by talking about Iran, since
Christmas came early in Tehran,
or maybe it came early in Washington.
Well, in Washington, sure, to some extent. Although, I mean, I think the Iranians have been, you know, trying to convince the international community for a while that they, in fact, didn't have a nuclear weapons program, and now the CIA agrees.
Okay, well, that's an interesting place to start, because so that's been my big question about the National Intelligence Estimate that just came out that said Iran is not, in fact, working on the military components, you know, the military side of things, at least, of a nuclear weapon, has been,
right.
Well, what, you know, assuming Iran did, in fact, give up its military program in 2003, why didn't they make this clearer to the international community? Because it seems as though there are real benefits to them to giving up such a program, in not limited to having certain embargoes lifted and so forth, that they've conspicuously failed to enjoy. But so your take is that actually they've been trying to persuade the international community they don't have a bomb? I mean, that they aren't pursuing the bomb?
Well, I mean, you know, of course, there's different actors there, but this has always been what they've been saying.
Wait, don't get crazy and complicated here, Matt.
Sure.
Different actors.
But you know, I mean, the official thing they've always said is that they're not building a bomb, you know, which is why they could have withdrawn from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but they haven't wanted to do that because, you know, they thought it would have an adverse international reaction. They've been saying, you know, we're inside this, we're following the rules. It's been difficult to convince people because they got caught with a secret weapons program. So when you're caught in a position like that, then just turning around a year later and saying, oh, yeah, well, you know, after you guys caught us, then we stopped, you know, it doesn't necessarily seem credible to people. So it's been an uphill battle. But, you know, there were these IAEA reports all earlier this year with Mohammed El-Baradei saying, you know, there's no evidence of a weapons program. And this is sort of just the furthest, I think, step along a train where you've actually seen a lot of developments this way. At the same time, you've seen a lot of, you know, blustery rhetoric from Ahmadinejad.
Well, right. And that's, I mean, one of the more interesting analyses I read was, I think, on the New Republic's blog, and I forgot who wrote it, but comparing Iran's behavior surrounding their weapons program to Saddam's behavior surrounding his weapons program in the run-up to the Iraq War, where, of course, the big question on everyone's mind once the WMD proved ephemeral was, well, why didn't Saddam just say so? And in fact, it's true that he did say so, but he seemed to be trying to play, or this was the New Republic argument, was that just as Saddam was trying to play the double game of denying he had the weapons program, but also trying to persuade his neighbors that he really did have the weapons program, that Iran has been trying to do the same thing. The strategic benefits to Iran of being perceived in the region as being close to having a nuclear weapon are large, so they've been trying to balance the need to placate the international community against the need to to at least pretend to be pursuing a bomb in some sense.
Right. I mean, that's possible. But another way of looking at it is just that the United States in particular, but other countries, have wanted to hold Iran to a tighter standard than a lot of other countries, than South Korea or Germany or Japan are held with regard to nuclear technology, in that there are a lot of countries that have sort of walked the science right up to the line where, you know, if the Japanese wanted to start building nuclear weapons, I think almost everyone thinks they could do so very quickly.
Right.
And the goal has been to try and prevent the Iranians from getting to that point. And of course, you can understand why American policymakers would treat Iran and Japan or Germany as different kinds of cases, but the Iranians, you know, being Iranian, have their own good reasons for trying to insist on the broadest possible construal of their rights, even if they want to maintain ultimately on the right side of world opinion and of you know, international sanctions.
So well, I guess so, but they aren't. I mean, this is I think the where the comparison to Libya that some people have made comes in. I mean. Mm-hmm. There is the alternate choice, which was the choice that Gaddafi made around the time of the invasion of Iraq, which is the point of view that the benefits of removing yourself from international pariah status and having various embargoes lifted and so on are so great that you might as well just go ahead and let people wander around your country and look at whatever programs you may or may not have.
Sure, but you have to remember, the Iranians were under all of these embargoes before the nuclear issue ever came on the table, for reasons that had to do with the hostages, with Hezbollah,
right.
With Israel, with whatever else. And the Iranians tried both a
little
bit.
Well, but Gaddafi
before.
But Gaddafi was under an embargo for a host of other reasons.
He was going back.
But it was his decision to essentially open up his country. To inspections and so forth that got sanctions that were in place for earlier reasons.
Sure. Right. But I mean, the point is that there was willingness on the U.S. side to make a deal like that. The Iranians appear to have tried to explore a Libya option, both right after the war in Afghanistan and right after the invasion of Iraq, and the Bush administration wasn't
right. No, our policy was regime change.
Those kind of deals. Well, and also we didn't want to give. The Iranians wanted a sort of seat at the table in Iraq and Afghanistan. They
right.
wanted various things that the Bush administration didn't want to give them. But that meant that even giving up entirely on the nuclear issue wasn't going to get them what they wanted ultimately, which was an end to these sanctions, which the long-standing American ones, which has actually been quite harmful to them, to their aviation and various other aspects of their economy. But the Bush administration turned down that opportunity, which naturally, I think, then from the Iranian point of view, why not be at least somewhat intransigent on the nuclear issues?
Well. Then here's my follow-up question, though. Why weren't they more intransigent? I mean, it seems like, again, the practical benefits of suspending their program in 2003, but not having the world know about it. I mean, there are some practical benefits in that, they can walk this balancing act and build up a civilian program and so forth. But it seems like, it seems like there are some awfully significant benefits to continuing the program, which is one of the reasons I think why a lot of people think that they probably have continued the program, regardless of what this what the NIE has to say.
Well, I don't know what the basis for that would be.
The central problem here is just that. U.S. intelligence on WMD issues has been faulty in almost every case across the board. So, frankly, I don't see, that much more reason to buy into this NIE than the last NIE. There'll be another NIE in 2 years and so forth. I mean, we get Iraq wrong in one direction, we get Pakistan wrong in another direction. I'm just curious, is there a particular reason to have more confidence in this than whatever assessment may come out 2 years from now?
Well, I mean, not simply as such, but this it appears to be backed up by the intelligence reporting from elsewhere, from the IAEA, and I think, really from what the Iranians are saying, which is that, they have an insistence on wanting to exercise the largest possible degree of rights over their civilian program. And I mean, it makes sense. Even if they, in a subjective sense, would like to build nuclear weapons, it would be perfectly reasonable for them to have suspended a military research program, because it would be useless unless they can get the civilian stuff to work, which they haven't been able to do. Just in terms of the policy issue, one way or another, this is, I think, a I think it's good politically if this report causes people to calm down a little bit. But they should have been calmer based on what, you know, we thought we knew a year ago. So in some sense, it's not totally relevant. But I think it reinforces the idea that we should more fully explore the diplomatic options and not simply assume the worst-case scenario here.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I'm a little skeptical that it is... Well, I'm... Obviously, there was a tremendous amount of alarmism, but in certain precincts, particularly of the conservative media and so on, I think that alarmism was... Well, I'm someone who thinks there was absolutely no way that the Bush administration was going to bomb Iran before it left office, no matter what. So I'm a little skeptical of the notion that this has changed things dramatically on
the policy
side.
Well, I think the alarmism distorts people's thinking about the diplomatic options that are available to us. Because there's a difference between when you just think about conducting negotiations, are you thinking about a country that's, you know, hell-bent on nuclear weapons? Are you thinking about a country that's toyed with them, that's backed off, that's maybe gone back forward again, and that's, you know, adjusting its ideas according to the circumstances? If it's the latter, you know, then it means, of course, we're not going to know for sure, and we can't have full confidence in anything unless we have real, meaningful, verifiable disarmament with intrusive inspections and so forth. But it also means that we should have some optimism about our ability to secure that in exchange for, you know, whatever else might get bargained for. And that's what changes here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just don't, you know, obviously you have Norman Podhoretz making the case for bombing Iran now, and you have a lot of people on the sort of liberal hawk side of the equation attacking people to their left for, mm-hmm. for, you know, being insufficiently alarmist about Iran. On the other hand, I just didn't see that. I saw the vast majority of analysts, both left and right, making the case for continued negotiations as it was, and for keeping the, you know, bombing Iran option off the table, and even, you know, keeping that option always on the table, but, you know, but keeping it always as a method of last resort. And I think you saw this even within the context of the Republican primary debates, where the candidates are trying to out-hawk each other in various ways. You know, you don't have anybody explicitly taking the Podhoretz position. So, I don't know. I guess I think some of the alarmism was coming from alarmists. Some of the alarmism was coming from people who, you know, again, for understandable reasons, had convinced themselves that Dick Cheney was going to order airstrikes on Iran, you know, with 2 months left in the Bush administration, no matter what anyone else did.
But in the sense that this
NIE takes that alarmism off the table as well. I mean, it seems like a lot of people on the left have said, well, now we know there's no way the Bush administration will bomb Iran. I think that that's a good thing, because it ratchets down the domestic tone of our foreign policy debate.
Right. I mean, to wax, you know, a little broderishly, maybe now we can, you know, have an Iran policy on a more bipartisan basis.
Yes.
Without, you know, the level of sort of...
Yes, bipartisanship at last, yes.
Yes, yes. It'll be
No, I actually think that's true. I mean, I think I was kind of expecting more in the hawkish press. I mean, obviously there have been, you know, the fair share of attacks on the way, you know, the way the NIE was written and so forth from people on commentaries, blog, and where have you. But I think there's, you know, there's been less... I think there's a pretty broad acceptance. I mean, I think if you go and read, for instance, David Frum had a post immediately after this came out, and, you know, David Frum is, one of the more hawkish voices on the right-wing spectrum, and he had a post immediately after this came out sort of laying out, different things that we should do now vis-a-vis Iran, and they included entering into negotiations on certain terms and so on. I mean, I think that the NIE has had an effect on conservative analysis of Iran, perhaps a greater one than I expected. But
yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, a partial exception to this is that you got a taste of this in a New Republic article by Yossi Klein Halevi, which I thought was not a great article on its own terms, but it shows that in at least some quarters in Israel, there's an enormous amount of sort of interest in pushing back on this continued, I would say, alarmism about Iran and I don't know, the edges of that debate that I can see, you know, without reading the Hebrew language press, still seem somewhat hysterical to me. You know, it's understandable why people in Israel would view this as, you know, more pressing, more threatening than people in the U.S. do.
I think so.
But they're still being talked about in oddly apocalyptic terms, to my view, especially to just simply assume that this report, as Halevi's piece does, is just a kind of like stab in the back directed at the state of Israel rather than a, you know, good faith assessment of the intelligence
community.
That the end may not be nigh, and maybe that's why people don't think the end is nigh.
No, but again, I mean, I think, yes, no, I agree, but I think that, you know, for Israelis in particular, this is the place where, you know, the problems of intelligence, you know, Israel is just in a different position vis-a-vis Iran than we are, and, you know, I mean, for them, you know, it is the famous Dick Cheney 1% doctrine.
Oh, sure.
Has a lot, you know, it has a lot more power in a country like Israel.
Right,
it is vulnerable in a way that we aren't.
But to me, I mean, this is obviously not the popular view over there, but to me, this makes the case for a much more serious effort at diplomatic engagement all the more pressing, because a successful outcome of negotiations would give you so much higher level of certainty about what it is you had accomplished than anything else you could possibly do. Even very extreme military measures against Iran would still leave you with this problem where you couldn't be really sure what was happening.
The problem for Israel is that Israel can't, you know, Israel can't do the diplomacy.
Israel is dependent
on the U.S. for diplomacy in a way that it isn't dependent on the U.S. In military terms. And that, I think, is... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. I mean, that's exactly true. I just mean that in terms of sort of, you know, Israel-centric interventions in the American political debate, from their perspective, I mean, of course, it's no good for us to reach a bad deal with Iran, but incredibly pressing, in fact, for the United States, if possible, to conduct some effective diplomacy with the Iranians. Because, as you say, the Israelis can't do it.
Right. Yeah, I'm just saying that I can see why, you know, as an American, the NIE is better news to me than it would be were I an Israeli, I think.
Okay.
Just because it reemphasizes their dependence on our diplomatic arms, and yeah, I mean, frankly, I don't think, you know, it's. It reinforces the vulnerability of Israel. I mean, I think the vulnerability of Israel is overstated in a lot of cases, but it is true that, you know, Israel's stuck in a position where, you know, you have the summit at Annapolis and all the Arab leaders come, and they won't even shake the Israeli, you know, the Israeli minister's hand. And so to the extent that the landscape of the Middle East is defined, you know, and the way we're supposed to deal with a hostile power like Iran is defined by diplomacy, I think, you know, it's understandable that in a strange way makes Israel, or could make Israelis more nervous than a situation where, you know, the military option seems like the best option, because, you know, your own state security is in the hands of, you know, Condoleezza Rice.
Sure.
But anyway, well, we've probably talked about this long enough, so maybe we should switch to the domestic front, where I think you had a provocative post the other day about how Barack Obama is bamboozling Republicans.
Oh yeah, well this was Jason Zangerly and I were both marveling at a Steve Hayes article, which was, you know, it's a profile of Obama. It's very sort of kind to Obama, and what was interesting about it was that Hayes didn't actually seem bamboozled. It wasn't as if his argument was that actually Barack Obama is much more conservative than other Democrats. He acknowledged that all Obama was doing was sort of, when talking to people, he would acknowledge the conservative point of view, almost just sort of restate what the conservative argument is and then say he disagreed.
Right.
But Hayes seemed to find this very, very impressive. And Obama, yeah, I mean, just
this was my impression reading The Audacity of Hope, that almost, you know, 50% of the book consisted of Obama taking a policy question. The one I remember best was, you know, the long section on judicial interpretation, where mm-hmm. he gave a long and respectful summary of, you know, Antonin Scalia's position on constitutional law and said, but ultimately, I differ with this. And then, expressed completely standard issue liberal positions about constitutional interpretation.
Right, and it's what you would expect from someone. He was a law professor at one point. You would expect anyone who had that job to be able to do a competent, job of summarizing the other side's point of view.
I'm kidding. Go on.
Right. But it seemed to have an impact on Hayes. Obviously, our colleague Andrew Sullivan likes Obama a lot. Andrew's not as conservative as many conservatives, but he also, acknowledges that, in fact, Obama has much more, lefty kind of opinions on all sorts of economic policy issues than he does.
Well, and in fact, the places...
You've seen this time and again, though, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, I think, and in fact, in Andrew's case, a lot of the places where Obama has sort of gestured made gestures in conservative directions are... issues like religion and politics, for instance, where Andrew, places where Andrew is essentially, almost to Obama's left in certain respects. I mean, Obama's liberalism is most pronounced in issues of, the welfare state, size of government, taxes and spending, and so on. And those are the issues where Andrew is furthest to the right. And yet, the Obama outreach, the Obama statement of "I respect you."
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you
see a converse phenomenon. You see, Chris Bowers has done a couple blog posts recently on Open Left that sort of summarize this, the liberal case against Obama pretty comprehensively, where it's focused on being upset at Obama's tendency to distance himself from sort of very partisan mm-hmm. figures on the left, Daily Coast, that kind of thing, to seem to place a lot of value on being liked or respected by certain people on the other side, to talk a lot about a desire to appeal to conservatives, that kind of thing. And it's prevented the anti-war candidate from picking up some of the constituency online and elsewhere that you might expect from him. Even though, again, objectively speaking, it doesn't seem to involve meaningful policy concessions.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it is something that you see, I think, in a lot of successful politicians, and I think it's interesting that it isn't emulated more. I think it was something that defined in certain ways both Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan. I think Clinton did it a little differently. He did it less, I think, by summarizing Republicans' positions than by slightly caricaturing them in a friendly tone. Clinton mm-hmm. Clinton would say, well, my Republican opponents feel that poor children shouldn't get government assistance, and we just fundamentally disagree about that. Uh-huh. Whereas Obama would say, my conservative opponents, worry about the limits of what government can do, and I respect those concerns, but...
Right, but Clinton also, I mean, especially for his time, was a much less orthodox policy agenda.
That's true.
Whereas Obama... I don't want to say he's precisely a down-the-road liberal, even necessarily far to Bill Clinton's left, but for his time, Obama has very conventional opinions on the sort of conventional Democratic Party opinions on the leading questions of the day. Bill Clinton, of course, had conventional opinions on a lot of policy questions, but also had controversial ones, which was... I feel like it gave the... rhetoric of conciliation, there were things you could point to as, what was the upshot of this?
Right.
When he said he was a different kind of Democrat, that meant something other than he had a somewhat different rhetorical style than other Democrats.
Yeah, no, that's true. I think conservatives, I think the conservative swoon for Obama is true folly, actually. But uh-huh. Time will tell. I think, you know, there are some people who I think realize that you've seen some conservatives in different ways, ranging from Bill Kristol to Bruce Bartlett, talking about Hillary Clinton as a Democrat conservatives can live with, or I think Kristol was, when she was waxing hawkish about foreign policy, he praised her as presidential and so forth. But it is, if you look, I was talking to some Republicans the other day about Hillary's healthcare plan and, how clever it was and so forth, and how it avoided a lot of the missteps of the early 90s plan and how it was very difficult to criticize and so on. And these guys, though, all then agreed that the biggest albatross around that plan was Hillary Clinton herself, and that, they didn't even want to think about having to deal with Obama pushing a plan that smart. So there is some realization, I think, in conservative ranks, but it's what we're talking about isn't confined to, Steve Hayes and Andrew Sullivan. If you look at polls, it consistently shows that, Barack Obama is the Democrat that Republican voters are most comfortable with having as president. Maybe that calculation makes sense. It's true that, you want to have somebody who you like in your living room for 4 years, even when, the famous living room test and so on. But I just think it's clear that Barack Obama, one, would be a much more liberal president than Hillary Clinton, and two, has the potential to be a much more Republican crushing president than Hillary Clinton. He has Reagan-esque qualities that from the other side of the spectrum that Clinton simply doesn't have. I think Clinton he should be feared rather than loved, but by conservatives, but.
We were remarking earlier, though, and I just saw some clearest confirmation of this in CBS poll that came out today, that it's John Edwards who polls by far, I think, the best of the Democratic nominees.
Yes, no, and that's
pretty much all the head-to-head matchups.
By a lot. It's not even like margin of error territory. I mean, he's winning by.
And it's consistent. I mean, it's against.
Right.
They polled separately against Huckabee, against Romney, against Giuliani. It shows that a white man such as ourselves can still get ahead, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that that's I would say there are three big plausible explanations for why this is the case, and one is just that Edwards is white, he is a male. I think his being Southern helps too. I don't think it's very hard to tell from polls what percentage of Americans wouldn't vote for a woman or would be disinclined to vote for a black man, just in part because nobody wants to tell pollsters that. But even if we're only talking 4% of the electorate or 2% of the electorate, that's still 4% of the electorate among independent voters. That's still a not insignificant chunk in a close election. So Edwards has that going for him. He also seems to have going for him, and I just checked a poll that seemed to confirm this, the fact that he still benefits in the public's mind from the fact that he ran as basically a centrist New Democrat in 2004. And if you look at the polls, Democratic primary voters consistently say that John Edwards is the most liberal candidate running, which is, I think, reasonably accurate. He's moved steadily to the left.
Well, he's now hit this sweet spot where a little while ago, everybody perceived him as the most conservative.
Even though
he'd adopted all of these much more liberal policy positions. But now, the Democratic primary voters are hearing what he's saying, but the general election voters aren't. So he polls extremely well, which in turn, I think, is something he'll want the primary voters to hear, at least.
Yeah, although I think that that can cut both ways in the sense, that to the extent that primary voters are concerned about electability, and I think 2004 showed that concern factors in, it isn't clear to me, you can go too far. Like, Edwards doesn't want to be perceived as too liberal, even among primary voters, because you know, he needs them to think that he's the most electable. And right now, given where he is in the polls, he could definitely use more primary voters thinking of him as the electable candidate. I mean, if I were him, I'd start running ads touting these numbers of, you know, how he does in head-to-head matchups.
Sure. Although, of course, you know, what he suffers from, to some extent, in terms of his head-to-head matchup polling, is just how poorly they show the Republicans doing across the board.
That's true.
You know, it's
only, yeah, only John McCain's, if these polls are any guide, only John McCain has a chance of beating the Democratic nominee.
Right. I mean, I think, obviously, the polls need to be taken with several grains of salt, but if you want to make the case for Edwards based on the polls, you know, it's saying something like he has a 22 percentage point gap, you know, him versus Romney, but that, you know, Obama has like 12 and Hillary has 9. So, you know, either you say, well, look, we need to discount these polls, in which case it's not clear what that really says about Edwards, or you say, well, we should take these polls very seriously, which says that anyone will win.
Right.
So, you know, so this is something, I mean, I would care about a lot if I were, like, a congressional candidate in a marginal district.
Right.
You know, where because in the real world, you know, margin of victory does matter. But on the simplest level, you know, this seems like a year in which Democratic voters can, you know, afford to be self-indulgent in terms of who they want to pick.
But see, I was going to suggest that he's in these polls. That's the fact that this is a Democratic year is one of the reasons he's so far up, because I think that he, you know, if you run the race generic Democrat versus generic Republican, the Democrat crushes the Republican.
Right.
And I think Edwards, you know, by virtue of his whiteness and maleness, but also by virtue of the fact that he, you know, has probably received a lot less press coverage than Obama mm-hmm. and Hillary, sort of fits he's almost the generic Democrat answer.
He's a less interesting public figure, has been less commented on.
Right. And, well, and I mean, that's obviously not something that he can, you know, he can push.
Oh, sure.
He can't cut an ad that says, you know, vote for me, I'll be the closest to the generic
you're
Democrat.
Right. I mean, he comes closest to just saying, we will run a Democrat with some Democrat views on things.
Right.
You know, against the Republican. And given the prevailing mood of the country, that's a winning formula.
I mean, do you think that Edwards has any chance at all of winning the nomination?
You know, I never say never, because I just remember that last time around, the ultimate results from Iowa were not something you could have predicted even this close to it.
Right.
So I don't know. I do have to say, in terms of electability, the fact that Edwards has agreed to accept matching funds in the campaign, I know, weighs against him in the minds of a lot of people I know who are otherwise Edwards fans. Just feel that he'd be playing at a financial disadvantage that Clinton or Obama wouldn't be playing at,
mm-hmm.
and you know, that this makes them just much less inclined to sort of get out front and say, hey, this guy has the most lefty, you know, issue papers, and he still polls the best, so let's just go vote for him.
Yeah, I wonder how much money matters in a general election now. I mean,
right. I mean, I don't know how much it really matters, but it has.
I wonder, and I have no idea, but just the diminishing marginal returns of the extra $15 million in, like, I think it clearly matters in a primary campaign. And, you know, given how often the national campaigns now come down to get out the vote efforts in Ohio and Florida, I suppose you can never have too much money.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, obviously $50 million well spent is going to be better than $60 million, you know, spent by idiots. But, you know, I mean, I think you've got to assume it matters. People put a lot of effort into raising it. Probably for a reason.
Well, the other suggestion, that speaking of white males, the other suggestion that, you know, been sort of floated by Jonathan Alter in Newsweek is that, you know, if Edwards loses Iowa, right, comes in third and second and is out, withdraws from the race, that this is the Joe Biden moment, and that this will be the moment when when Democratic voters look around, you know, they aren't happy with Hillary, she's wounded, they aren't ready to commit to Obama, and there's a space for another white male to slip in. And I thought that this was pretty ludicrous, but I just wanted to run it by you.
I think even if there were to be such a ludicrous come from behind figure like that, it would more likely be Chris Dodd.
You do? Okay, why?
Because liberals, if you ask just like some D.C. liberal people, you know, who are they like Chris Dodd. You know, Chris Dodd is someone who a lot of people, I think, feel if you could take the politics out of politics, you know, would be thrilled to have him be the Democratic presidential nominee. He's been solid on, you know, all the group's sort of core issues.
Right.
Has shown over the years, like, some real leadership on obscure subjects, constitutional procedure issues under Bush, Central America policy under Reagan. You know, the kind of fights that, you know, you can get away with not picking.
Right, and that interest groups remember.
Right, but not just that interest groups remember, because, I mean, this is the point. These are things where there wasn't strong interest group pressure to take the liberal position. But, you know, but Dodd did it anyway. Because he's a liberal, you know. And so people like him and respect him, and if for some reason, you know, events seem to be moving in his direction, I think people would applaud that. Joe Biden, I think...
Joe Biden, I think reporters and columnists love, or don't love, but, I mean, they, you know, he gets a certain amount of mockery, but you also get the sense that the media generally likes Joe Biden.
Yes, there's a circle of people in the press who aren't, like, really liberal. I mean, the people who like Joe Biden aren't the right people, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, whoever does booking for Tim Russert seems to like Joe Biden a great deal, but you don't, you're sort of, you know, a liberal on the street, not on the street, but, you know, in Washington, people think, you know, that Joe Biden is a blowhard, and that, you know, he's a camera hog, and so on and so forth, and don't, you know, bear him any particular affection. The group of people who thinks he stands head and shoulders above other Democrats tend to be foreign policy hawks who, you know, are not a like key driving force in the party at this moment.
No, but I mean I don't think. I can't believe we're sitting here weighing the relative chances of Joe Biden and Chris Dodd.
Oh, sure.
When they both make their move, we'll have to dig up this clip and look incredibly prescient. But I don't think that one should underestimate the ability of even now the mass media to elevate someone that they like. I mean, I think, you know, to turn to the GOP side, you know, the Huckabee phenomenon. You know, if you look at Mike Huckabee, right, who is essentially the, you know, he would be the equivalent of Biden or Dodd suddenly rising from, you know, from obscurity because there was dissatisfaction with the earlier choices. Huckabee has no constituency in the institutional GOP. His constituency, now he has a grassroots constituency that neither, you know, that Joe Biden certainly wouldn't have, but Huckabee's other constituency has been the media. And that's made a big difference.
But Huckabee, I think, is about to get destroyed precisely because, as you say, I mean, Huckabee has no sort of institutional friends or allies. And also, the thing about Huckabee is that despite his long duration as governor of Arkansas, he was a completely obscure figure to the national media.
Right, that's true. Right, whereas Joe Biden was, you know, plagiarizing his speeches when you and I were in grade school, so.
Right, I mean, Biden and Dodd are both not well-known figures around the country, but they're both long-time Washington establishment figures who were, you know, in people were writing stories about them in the 80s.
Right.
So nobody is going to just sort of out of nowhere swoon for either of them. Or just... Because one thing that's happened a lot with Huckabee, and I've done it, Frank Rich was doing it a couple days ago, you know, is write about Huckabee just to sort of make an unflattering point about the Republicans who aren't Huckabee, rather than seriously thinking about Huckabee himself.
Huckabee as president, yeah.
Right, right. I mean, exactly. I mean, Huckabee is a useful narrative trope because he, you know, seems in some ways to stand for a more humane vision of conservatism than is the general direction that the Republican primary has been going in. So you know, he's gotten a lot of glowing coverage that's not really about him. I don't think you'll see anyone in the press who's in fact enthusiastic about, you know, a creationist who thinks we need to quarantine AIDS patients.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think you'd see them enthusiastic about him in a general election, but I think you shouldn't underestimate the continued press enthusiasm for him as long as he's only being judged in comparison with Mitt Romney, who nobody likes, and Rudy Giuliani, who, you know, most of the press corps thinks is crazy, and Fred Thompson, who's run a terrible campaign. You know, the only other person who can get glowing coverage from the national press on the Republican side is John McCain. And this gets us. This is something we were going to talk about, but I tried to make this point the other day that, you know, you have this weird phenomenon on the Republican side where it doesn't seem like any of the candidates can possibly win the nomination. Because what you were just saying about Huckabee is absolutely true. You know, he has no institutional support within the party. He has no money. He has, you know, no policy team, so far as I can discern. I mean, for his signature policy is the fair tax, and the reason that's his signature policy is that he himself read the pro fair tax book a couple years ago and was really taken with the idea.
Well, the immigration plan he came out with recently,
right? He just
it
took
appears to be just literally copied from the, you know.
I actually think
Center for Immigration
I thought was pretty savvy, actually.
It's savvy in some ways, but it just bespeaks a
right. No, it bespeaks it's the savvy that you have when you don't have a policy apparatus. Go and you say, well, we're vulnerable on immigration. We'll just take the restrictionist plan proposed by Mark Krikorian of National Review.
But include a line about the fair tax. Right. But, you know, as what he did with the fair tax, I think in some ways he thought that was a similar clever thing. Like, let me take some already worked out conservative policy proposal, you know, and just kind of make it my own, outsource the policy work, without having, in that case, done the due diligence to see that, like, even the Wall Street Journal editorial
board
thinks this is stupid.
You
know, and so he screwed up. With immigration, he's got the sweet spot. I mean, conservatives do, in fact, think the Center for Immigration Studies are people you should be listening to. But if you keep just putting your policies together in this way, you're going to wind up making more blunders. I mean, you need people who know, you don't know the terrain.
Well, and you need people who can do things like tell you what the national intelligence estimates that came out the day before said about Iran, which Huckabee didn't know 24 hours after it came out. And it just bespeaks a campaign that, you know, you would think couldn't possibly win the nomination, except that it's up against a series of other campaigns that, you know, can't possibly win the nomination. Fred Thompson's because he's run a terrible campaign and everybody's already written him off. Mitt Romney because, you know, he's spent all kinds of money, but nobody likes him because he seems like a phony. Rudy Giuliani because he, you know, doesn't have a conservative record and has 6,000 skeletons in his closet. And John McCain, who has incurred the hatred of the conservative base over the years, doesn't have any money and doesn't seem to have a plausible path to victory, even if he wins New Hampshire. So nobody can win.
Right.
But somebody's going to win.
Presumably.
Right?
I mean,
presumably.
Obviously it's always possible that you'll see a brokered convention. People always say that. But I've noticed that there's been an eerie lack of speculation about that this time around.
There was a good piece in National Review Online by David Ferdoso that you need a certain patience for wonkery, but it actually tried to work through the delegate math and the primary schedule, and it made the case that, you know, this is a brokered convention is as plausible this year for the Republican side as it ever will be in a, you know, in the system we have now.
Right. And what I'll say on behalf of that is that this time around, I think it's plausible that that would be actually a good scenario for the Republican Party. That something like that would let them come up with a better nominee than would Mitt Romney limping over the finish line somehow or something. I mean, catastrophic could happen if Huckabee wins Iowa and then there's some sudden front loading effect and he becomes the nominee with no money, no staff. I mean, he'd be a joke candidate, and yet he's second in national polls now by like a hair. Whereas, I don't know. You could at a broker convention, you could have a draft Jeb movement or get I don't know. How come the governor of Texas isn't running?
Perry? Rick Perry. From what I hear, Rick Perry is in line to be Rudy Giuliani's vice presidential pick, but.
It seem like a governor of Texas with a solid conservative record?
I have yet to meet a single human being who is enthusiastic about the idea of Rick Perry, national politician. I don't know that much about him, but I would be skeptical of the draft Rick Perry movement. I mean, I think that the thing that Republicans, if it came to a brokered convention or in the primaries, I think it's increasingly clear that John McCain, as most people expected a year ago, would be the strongest general election candidate.
Right. Yes. And Republican conservative elites
have figured this out.
Have like re-reconciled themselves to McCain, in part because conservative. I mean, there's disagreement, but the immigration issue is not, I think, nearly as much of a deal breaker when you get into more rarefied circles.
Yeah, well, and I also think there's a recognition that, it's not as if Mitt Romney or Rudy Giuliani are true blue immigration restrictionists either. And McCain has, all of the Republican candidates are on that issue, with the exception of Tom Tancredo and Ron Paul, are people whose fundamental sympathies are probably pro-comprehensive immigration reform. And they're just being, they're sort of being pushed towards restriction first. And McCain is just explicit about that. He comes out and says, yes, I'm in favor of restriction first because I learned my lesson last year. Right. Whereas the others sort of pretend. But yeah, I mean, I think conservative elites sort of appreciate that landscape. And conservative elites also, don't have the kind of personal antipathy that, that some rank and file conservatives seem to have, and I'm not sure why that is. I mean, I guess I understand why it is, that McCain has been the guy who's like palling around with Democrats in the liberal press for a long time, but it really doesn't seem like he has a greater record of being a crypto liberal than the people he's running against.
Right.
But the problem for McCain, I mean, I think people have been talking up the, McCain's comeback story for a long time now. And for a while there was a McCain comeback. I mean, he dropped to, 5 to 10% in the national polls. It looked like he was going to run out of money, fired all his campaign staff and so on. And then, then he sort of pulled things together. He's clearly going to be in it through the first few primary states. And he got back up to about, 10 to 15% of the national polls, 15 to 20%. Excuse me, in New Hampshire, and so there was this surge, but now it's stopped. I haven't seen McCain have any movement really in New Hampshire in the past month or so. And
I thought he was leading in New Hampshire now. Oh no, Romney.
No, Romney. Yeah, Romney's even, I think, increased his lead even as he's been losing ground to Huckabee in Iowa.
Right.
And to a lesser extent.
But isn't the McCain path, this mobilization against Huckabee comes not in time, and Huckabee wins Iowa.
Right.
And at that point, there's a sense among people, including people with money, who can give McCain some quick infusions, that you need to stop Huckabee, and that Romney's not credible in that regard. McCain's there second in New Hampshire. and there's a move toward him, thinking, you know, look, like, if we let Huckabee win any more states and Rudy's too far behind in the early ones, we'll be done. So people get behind McCain. McCain wins in New Hampshire. South Carolina is also a pretty good McCain state. He wins there. And then, given how implausible it is that anyone else will win at this point, McCain's chance to see him about as good as anyone else's.
Yeah, no, I think so. I just would like, I'd like to see him get above. I mean, yeah, it all, as you say, it all depends on the idea that people are going to wake up after Iowa, after Huckabee wins Iowa, which he probably will, but, you know, God, who knows? I guess God does know, but we don't. You know, people wake up and they say, you know, okay, McCain's our guy. I'm just not... It seems like that should be happening already. Like, it seems right. Like Mitt Romney's weaknesses, both as a primary candidate and as a general election candidate, should be apparent enough by now that sort of, you know, come to Jesus, come to McCain moment should have started happening, and I haven't seen it happen.
I mean, of course, it's also plausible that Romney's now going on the air with these anti-Huckabee ads,
right?
And that he'll actually be able to fight off the Huckabee challenge in Iowa. That to some people, this whole episode will have underscored Romney's strength as a candidate rather than
weakness. Romney
then he just wins New Hampshire, he gets the nomination, and the Republicans have a kind of weird liar as their nominee. But you know, I've voted for Mitt Romney, so I should never cast total electability.
I think Mitt Romney could be a good president. I don't think he can win, particularly in this year, a general election. But I think he could be a good president. I just wish that, you know, he hadn't run possibly the least appealing primary campaign, you know, imaginable. And almost every, you know, both his calculations and his gaffes have been off-putting, it seems to me.
Yes, well, it's also, it's weird to run as almost explicitly as Romney has, sort of as a phony. he didn't say this, but I mean, the pitch really did seem to be that
Mitt Romney
should vote for Mitt Romney because he was willing to pretend he was one.
Well, or because he will pretend is probably, it's just Mitt Romney is willing to become one.
Sure, right, if that's what you want him to do.
Right.
But it was, I've never seen so little sort of effort at sincerity put forward in something like that. And it's a little strange. Was it Noah Millman who had the post about how, you know, you have all these candidates who seem wounded because of their ideological heterodoxies, and yet you don't see a debate,
right,
about the idea, with different people saying the party should go in different directions. Instead, you have everyone sort of denying that they are any kind of deviationist.
The reason
the race is so interesting is that they all are.
Right, and you should be able to have, I mean, yes, if Rudy Giuliani were running as, you know, the politician he were in the 90s, and Mitt Romney were running as the politician he were, and, I mean, I think Mike Huckabee, to a certain extent, and certain, obviously Ron Paul, are articulating actual departures, but the sort of McCain-Romney-Giuliani axis, which should have all kinds of interesting things to fight about, is instead, you know, trying to agree with each other as much as possible on the issues. But it's also interesting to contrast it with the Democratic side, where, it's almost a completely non-ideological race. I mean, nobody, you know, you're having obviously this fight about, Obama's healthcare plan doesn't include mandates, and Hillary's and Edwards' plans do. And, you know, that's obviously a real policy distinction. It's not a huge policy distinction, and it's really the only one that's come up. Everything else is sort of, you know, the politics of, like, oh, Hillary's too compromised and Obama's too green and so on. And as a result, Democratic primary voters seem very happy with their choices, which is interesting.
Right, and you know, even on healthcare, I mean, well, you definitely, I mean, there's a policy difference there, and there are policy differences on various fronts. Nobody on the Democratic side has tried to argue that the problem with one of the other nominees is that they don't, at the end of the day, share
right.
like commitment to the same core values. Even Clinton and Obama's, they're back and forth on healthcare. Basically been technocratic in nature,
yep.
you know, like an argument between two liberal healthcare policy people, you know, like arguing about what presidential candidates ought to say rather than a real sort of dispute. And it's been the same with Obama's sort of sniping at elements of Hillary's foreign policy record, is that he's pointed at Iraq, this Iran vote, and tried to say, well, you know, she has bad judgment. But he hasn't tried to say, look, there's some systematic difference between me and her.
Right.
You know, she's like this, and I'm like that. And you know, we face real choice here. You know, possibly because the sort of, you know, bad vibes from George W. Bush have brought people together. But also because I think the generally favorable tide has... typically, on the Democratic side, you'll see the front runners sort of unveiling policy positions that they know won't necessarily go over all that well with primary voters because that's what they think they need to run on in the general election.
Right.
But this time around, everyone has been very willing to come up with, you know, really sweeping
right.
global yep. warming and healthcare plans, on which are, I guess, you know, the big issues. And people seem to feel, you know, whether or not they can pass that through Congress, they feel they can win a general election on promises to, you know, huge increases in the federal role and in provision of healthcare and,
yep.
you know, draconian in a good way, environmental measures, and at which point, you know, there's relatively little to disagree about.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that this is one of the GOP's very few advantages in this cycle. One of the only things the Republicans have going for them is that what's being masked by the Democratic contentment with their candidates and the Republican discontent with their candidates is that, you know, just in terms of their record of accomplishments, I think the GOP field is arguably much more impressive than the Democratic field. And you've sort of had this, debate in on the Republican side a little bit. I think, you know, a couple conservative columnists, Charles Krauthammer, I think, have written columns saying, here's why, you know, conservatives shouldn't be dissatisfied with the field,
mm-hmm.
Even as conservatives are dissatisfied with the field. And I think that both of these points of view are right. Like, the Republican field includes, you know, figures who have done pretty impressive things in their lives, and arguably sure. more impressive than the leader. You know, I mean, Mitt, whatever one thinks of Mitt Romney's various flip-flops, you know, he has been a success in three pretty big arenas. And you know, whatever one thinks of Rudy Giuliani, he was a very surprisingly successful mayor of New York. And whatever one thinks of John McCain, he has a long and successful legislative record, and before that he was a war hero. And I think all three of them
sure.
are, you know, if you just put together the biographical ad, and admittedly in Giuliani's case you have to, you know, remove the ex-wives and Bernie Kerik and so on, but the biographical
right.
ad for those guys, I think, is all better than the biographical general election ad for Edwards or Hillary or Obama. I mean, I think Obama's biographical ad is the kind of biographical ad that that the liberal media, if you will, eats up, you know, the sort of, you know, Michael Kinsley.
Sure,
wrote this
I mean,
column.
You know, with
Obama
with Hillary,
as world man, I think was his term.
But I think Mitt Romney's biographical. There's the question of, you know, I mean, this has come up in the Democratic debate of, you know, what view do you take of her sort of role as First Lady. But, you know, I mean, if you put together the voters who thought at the time that Bill Clinton was a good president, plus the voters who, looking at George W. Bush, think that in retrospect Bill Clinton was a pretty good president. You know, I think you've got a solid majority there. That, you know, even though her biographical ad is, it's not going to be interesting to people because we're obviously all aware that, that she's Bill Clinton's wife. You know, I think at the end of the day, still serves as a real asset to her.
Yeah, I think it serves as an asset. I think that, like, look, obviously there are all kinds of structural reasons why, you know, this may make no difference and this is probably just a Democratic year. But, you know, that Hillary Clinton biographical ad, I mean, yes, the idea of a 90s restoration, I think, is appealing to a lot of people, but it's still a tough ad to create. You know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff you have to finesse, and you have the weird thing where, like, she has to run on her experience as first lady, but, like, without saying, like, as first lady, I was co-president, you know? Whereas,
yeah,
you know, I mean, Mitt Romney's ad is, it's really straightforward, you know? Mitt Romney, you know, built Bain, saved the Olympics, ran Massachusetts. You know, I mean, these are accomplishments that don't have any kind of weird, you know, what is a first lady really
Sure.
It's a classic American story, Matt.
Right. I mean, the Republicans have, well, sure. The Republicans, except for McCain, all have this management experience, and Ed McCain was in war. You know, so, I mean, they have that going for them, and they do, I think, have going for them that the terms of the political debate have shifted, I think, have already shifted a lot further left than people sort of quite realize, because they've been tracking the two campaigns independently, but when these primaries are over, you're going to end up with a Democrat who's running on a much more liberal platform than John Kerry or Al Gore.
And there's room for the Republican to then, yeah, move to the center, you know, to recognize.
To some extent, the structural advantage facing the Democrats is already built into the way the Democratic primary is playing out, and will wind up kind of burning some of that ill will that conservatives have built up about themselves. I mean, especially because, precisely because some of these Republicans have such sort of scant credentials as conservatives, because there's been a vacuousness to some of the policy aspects of the Republican debate, there's actually going to be a lot of room, I think, for the nominee to sort of stake out some centrist terrain on a couple of
mm-hmm.
issues.
Yeah. I agree. It's just, you know, it's impossible to know who that nominee could possibly be.
Sure. Progressive fair tax.
Yeah. well, shall we wrap things up then?
I think we should.
All right. It's a pleasure talking to you, Matt.
Always is.
All right. Take care.